Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Today's episode has been sponsored by Jay McLachlan. Jay McLachlan is a timeless lifestyle brand with incredible style and a spirit of connection. I am obsessed with Jay McLachlan and have been so honored that they are sponsoring my Zibbyverse tour. It just so happens that the tour goes to so many communities and areas of the country that have Jay McLachlan stores. And I love that the brand is philanthropic through Jay McLachlan's local and loyal programming. Host store events to give back to organizations that are meaningful to Jay McLachlan's local communities. I also love the fact that the clothes are just so chic. They make me feel polished and modern, and the best part is that most of the line comes in fabrics that don't wrinkle. I especially love the dresses, the cashmere sweaters, the other sweaters. You'll see them all over my Instagram. I typically tag at Jay McLachlan. And so you can check it out. It is absolutely one of my favorite brands, and I am over the moon excited to be working with them. In fact, I want to share the love with all of you. Jay McLachlan is giving 20% off new customers and listeners of my podcast with special code ZIBBY20, capital ZIBBY 20. That's 20% off for new customers and listeners of the podcast with special code capital Z Zibby 20. Take advantage of it today. My favorites are this white, open, long cashmere sweater that I've been wearing on every flight that I've taken on this tour. I have a blue with light blue horizontal striped sweater, several dresses I even wore on Good Morning America. Check it out, Jay McLachlan. Thanks so much. Welcome to Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books with Zibby. I'm the host, Zibby Owens. I am an author. My latest is blank, pub date March 1st, a novel. I'm also a podcaster, obviously, a publisher, a bookstore owner, and so much more. If you love books, you're in the right place. In fact, we call it the Zibbyverse, or really, the LA Times called it the Zibbyverse, and we're going with it. Go to ZibbyOwens.com to learn more and follow me on Instagram at Zibby Owens. Rachel Capelke-Dale is the author of The Fortune Seller, a novel. This episode was guest hosted by Alicia Fernandez-Miranda, author of My What If Year, which is a Zibby Books title. Rachel Capelke-Dale is the author of The Ingenue and The Ballerinas and co-author of Graduates in Wonderland. She received a BA from Brown University, where she rode on the varsity equestrian team, an MA from the Université de Paris Diderot, and a PhD from University College London. How did you like that accent? Right? Pretty good? She currently lives in Paris.
Rachel, welcome to Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Happy New Year. We're still in early 2024 here. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me on. It's great to meet you and to talk with you and to be back on the pod.
Well, I am extremely excited because this weekend I dove into your book, which I had the good fortune to read early, probably the best thing about this job. And it was such a page turner. Like I could not stop. And I have a very bad habit of reading the ends of books before I finish them. It's horrible. My New Year's resolution should probably be to change it, but I think it's impossible. But of course, I had to keep like, I was like, wait, I don't understand. I have to go back. I have to finish. So yeah, it had me hooked. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm really glad to hear that and delighted that it kept the tension going for you.
Yeah, good job on that. So why don't we start with just telling listeners who aren't as lucky as I have been what The Fortune Seller is about?
Absolutely. So The Fortune Seller is a book about Ivy League equestrian team in the mid-aughts, which feels so weird to say still, and young tarot card reader who kind of infiltrates the team and brings a lot of tensions to the forefront. And yeah, and kind of the fallout from there, figuring out who she is and why she's there and what it means to the other girls on the team.
So I know this is your third novel, and I also know you were already kind of, it was in the works when you were on Zibby's podcast last for your previous book. What was the inspiration for this? And, you know, what's kind of some of the backstory about how you decided to come to this story of these girls and their drama?
Well, there's so much about this book that I'd always wanted to write about. You know, I rode horses myself when I was younger. I always thought that was a fascinating arena, not just to write about the animals, which I love, but to write about the class tensions within that world, because it is such a strange world. And the book gets into this where you have people who can be in it, who aren't born from money usually because riding's so expensive, who can be in that world only if they put actual labor into it, mm-hmm. you know, working as grooms, working as instructors, things like that, and then the very wealthy. So it's a really interesting kind of point of class meetings. And so I always wanted to use that for a book. The title was actually something that came along before almost anything else in this book. And it came from one of my favorite books as a kid, which was the Emily of New Moon series, the Lucy Maud Montgomery series. She, the heroine Emily, works for so long to be a writer. She's, you know, she's a kid with literary ambitions, as many kind of Victorian heroines are. And eventually, I think one of her first big successes is when she gets a title from an old piece she finds in a newspaper called something like The Seller of Dreams, something very Victorian like that. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, that had kind of stayed with me and morphed in my mind into The Fortune Seller. Although when I went back and reread the book, it was totally different. I thought, I like the title. What would I do with that? You know, and again, you know, the equestrian world had always been something that appealed to me as a place to set a novel for precisely those class tensions. And I thought, oh, that could be interesting. And from there, you know, I set out almost with like a Mad Libs of things that I want to write about. You know, I'd wanted to write about tarot. I'd wanted to write, you know, a little bit about astrology. Wanted to write about what it's like to be in New York right after graduation, you know, without any money in particular. So these things came together in various ways. Wanted to write a dog in there. I love putting a dog in my books. and kind of whittling and seeing thematically what works. And, you know, I'm not sure I think so much about theme while I'm drafting, but in revisions, of course, that starts to come through. So my first drafts do tend to be kind of a hodgepodge of just things I like.
Are you a pantser or a plotter? So did you already know kind of what was going to happen? Because the story is, it really unfolds. And it's one of those great stories that when you go back after you know what's happened, in my case, midway through the book, or in other people's case, when they actually finish. You know, you see all of these beautiful kind of Easter eggs and little clues that were dropped throughout. So is that how you write? Do you write based on an outline, or are you more of like, let's see where this goes?
So for a long time, I really was a pantser, but I ended up with a lot of novels, a lot of manuscripts that were just people sitting around and talking. You know, I have ADHD. I think I've mentioned that before. My brain will let me go 800 pages into a conversation I find interesting and nobody else cares about it. So I really, you know, but that's also where some of the gold is. So I like to kind of have a few months to a year before I start writing, actually writing on the page, where I'm just kind of wool gathering and jotting things down, and the stakes don't feel as high as if I thought of it as like actual drafts.
Right.
But, you know, but when I write in my notes app, you know, little moments or sentences or ideas for scenes, that's my wool gathering process. Mm-hmm. And then I arrange it into an outline. I have these absurdly complicated Excel spreadsheets.
I love
to waste time needlessly organizing things that don't need to be that carefully organized, but that really helps me too with revisions because I can see what scenes are necessary to the structure of the book. I can see what scenes are no longer necessary. You know, they may have been early on, but, you know, at a certain point fall away. I can see, you know, the scenes that were in earlier drafts and things like that without having to go generalize from a manuscript. So yeah, I do end up plotting pretty carefully in the end, but I don't come to a novel with a predetermined plot. When I do that, the characters come out kind of, they come out very forced, you know. Yeah. It has to, you have to kind of listen to the characters as you write and adapt from there, because it's all about what they do in any given situation. Right. And if the situation isn't right or what they would do isn't right, then, you know, particularly with, you know, this novel where you have four girls, or a novel like this, four girls from what I think are pretty similar backgrounds, ranging from middle class to super upper class. Yeah. But I mean, they're four young women of the same generation, all relatively comfortable plus on up, you know, of the same race, of the same education. I think, you know, the fear that I have going into that is that I don't have them differentiated enough to get their voices distinct, you know, and their voices really come from, you know, come out of the actions that they take. And as I kind of figure out the kind of people that they are. So as that develops over drafts, sometimes scenes no longer make sense and they gotta go.
Are you good at doing that? Are you good at killing your darlings?
I am. And the only reason for that, again, is just I know how my brain works. And if there's something, and I know that I will write, you know, I will write a 50-page description of a horse or a dog that nobody cares about, you know, and I'm like, well, I'm glad I know that dog. Okay, let's take that out of the book and, you know, move
on. Put it on the wall, we'll write, you know, it'll be ode to the dog. Exactly.
I have a lot of documents on my computer that are just those darlings for another time, for another draft, you know, for a different project.
Yeah, that's very good. So, I mean, you mentioned this a little bit, but, you know, this book is about this horse community where you have a number of different people coming from different parts of life and different socioeconomic strata that can come together. But it also takes place in the Ivy League, in this very upper echelons, very kind of locked off place of society. And you're talking about class and privilege and how they intersect there and how difficult it can be to break in. So, you know, I mentioned I was in my childhood home with my parents. You are also at your parents' house right now. So I was reading your book over the weekend, and then we were playing a lot of board games, right? So we were playing the Game of Life with my children, which I don't know if you've played that game ever or like in the last however many years, but you know, you start, the way the game works now is that you get a salary card at the beginning. And if you start with a small salary, your chances of digging yourself out of that financial hole by the end of the game are like almost impossible, which is kind of similar to life. And I pulled out this quote that yes. Rosie says earlier in the book. So early in the book, Rosie is the main character. She says, "The idea that all of life was open to you, not just a little sliver of it, that all you had to do was go around pointing at things, experiences, people, saying mine, mine, mine. The ability to choose, that was my idea of heaven." And so I was thinking about all of these things as I'm playing the Game of Life and losing miserably against my children, my extremely competitive son, who's like hiding his money under the bed so no one can see how much he has. But I went to Harvard for my undergrad. I graduated in 2004. A lot of these experiences are very relatable for me, believable. I met people like Cress, another main character in the book. And I saw that you also went to an Ivy, you went to Brown. So did you know people like this when you came into this world? Is that part of the book also based on experiences that you had kind of coming into the Ivy League from wherever you were coming from?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I should say that nothing in the book actually happened to me. You know, it's the vibes did, but nothing. You know, none of the murders or anything. But, yeah, I grew up with my parents are both professors in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And when I was leaving for Brown, I'll never forget, you know, my father said to me, you know, you're going to encounter people from backgrounds that you've never encountered before, you know, at Brown. And I thought, oh my God, you know, what kind of Great Gatsby talk is this? You know, this is so ridiculous. But then you get there and yeah, you know, it had been, you know, expected that I would, yeah, you know, and again, like I was very comfortable as a child. Mm-hmm. Like my background was fairly comfortable, middle class. And, you know, but it was expected that I would work a job for spending money, you know, and that, you know, when I graduated, this is, so I graduated 07. So still no, I wasn't covered under my parents' health insurance. Mm-hmm. So, my mom was like, you're getting a job because, you know, health insurance is what, $1,000 a month? And, you know, that's just what you do. But at the same time, you know, a lot of the people that I knew, you know, were on this spectrum that was even more privileged than, you know, than the background that I had come from, where, you know, they were going, oh, well, my parents say my job is to be a student. I'm going, well, that must be nice. or buying $100 bottles of wine at dinner and this kind of thing. And it's, you know, it's delightful to be around, of course, but it really was different from anything that I'd ever experienced, you know. And then at the same time, you know, there were kids in my class who were coming out with huge financial aid packages, student loans, things, you know, just this place where I think, especially growing up in kind of 90s middle class middle America, especially, I had thought, you know, well, we live in a meritocracy, you know, and it's, yeah. I really, really believed that to the point where I hadn't questioned it. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're surrounded by these levels of wealth, you know, that other 18-year-olds have access to. You're going, wait a minute, none of us has done anything to deserve any of this.
Yes.
You know, whether it's being, you know, born with the privilege to get there or the intelligence to get there or the combination or the work ethic to get there. But again, see, even now I'm going, oh, the work ethic to get there, as though just work ethic can get you to an Ivy, whereas really it's systems. So I think, yeah, I think the Ivies have always interested me as institutions, as this kind of byword for privilege, but also this byword for, oh, you can get there if you work really hard. Yeah. And it takes that, certainly, but in most cases, if you're not Cressida Tate from the book, but it also takes a lot of luck. And I think that's the kind of X factor. And I think you must get this with Harvard. I mean, especially because, you know, I live in France, I went to Brown, but people kind of know what it is, but they don't really. Whereas Harvard all over the world, is kind of owning it after graduation is a strange thing. Because after graduation, I was in New York and people go, oh, you went to Brown. Well, why are you doing this job? Because it's a job, because it's work. The health insurance, you know, but the, you know, you go, oh, well, I just remember being really uncomfortable with people's judgments of that, you know, and going, oh, well, you must be so smart. And you're going, well, no, it's luck. And it's even and just this, which is probably a very middle-class trait too. You know, again, the Cressida Tate in the book is not somebody who's going, oh, I went to Yale, but I'm not that smart.
It's so funny. I'm sure she's not. My son, who's 12, will sometimes like he, you know, he now knows what Harvard is because he sees it on TV and in shows and stuff like that. And he's like, just say to me all the time, like, Mom, I can't believe you were smart enough to go to Harvard. I'm like, first of all, ouch. Second of all, yes, I was. But third of all, you know, you do need to understand. And I think one of the great benefits actually of my experience there was being able to see a lot of the underlying machinations in the system of how that world works in a way that you never could have explained to me before I got there, because you start to see, you know, you see how inherited privilege and generational privilege, how it manifests itself among your peers and among friends. And there are lots of ways to take advantage of that. My thing was always like with boys, like you never wanted to tell boys after college that you went to Harvard because you didn't want them to think you were too smart. So like, I went to college in Boston. It took me a little while to own that properly, but now I'm so far out. Nobody cares where I went to college anymore. It's like, I'm very far away. I'm very aged.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. As kids get older, some things about parenting can get easier. I mean, not many, but some. But others don't, like having conversations about money. Point is, kids won't really know how to manage their money unless they're actually in charge of it, and that is where Greenlight can help. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. Parents can send money to their kids and keep an eye on their kids' spending and saving, while kids and teens build money confidence and lifelong financial literacy skills. With the Greenlight app, kids can learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely, thanks to games that teach money skills in a fun and accessible way. I got Greenlight debit cards for my kids. The greatest thing, you can actually add their photos that take up half the card. So when I handed the cards to the kids, they were like, this is so exciting. So they look great. Unfortunately, I only put the required 2 cents on at the beginning to make sure they worked. So the kids were like, well, what should I spend my 2 cents on? Anyway, millions of parents and kids are learning about money on Greenlight. It's the easy, convenient way for parents to raise financially smart kids and families to navigate life together. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/Zibby. That's greenlight.com/Zibby to try Greenlight for free. Greenlight.com/Zibby.
So you mentioned you live in Paris. What brought you there? Tell me about your like fabulous expat life where you like wear stripes and eat baguettes and wear those like frou-frou outfits like Emily in Paris. I bet, you know, are you just walking around in super high heels all day long? Tell me.
I have not worn heels since the pandemic, but I should
love
say.
It. I love that for you. I love it.
But yeah, I studied abroad in Paris and then I did my master's there because I realized when I was studying abroad that while our parents and our, you know, student loans were paying 40 grand a year, whatever it was at the time, the French students who were being exchanged were paying about 300 in tuition, which included health insurance. Ooh. So as soon as I had the chance after college, I worked in New York for a while. Then I decided to go do my master's in France for, you know, again, like $300 a year, health insurance included. And then I got kind of caught up in that system and in the academia of it all again. I ended up doing my PhD. I did that in London because my written French isn't strong enough to do, you know, a doctorate in. Yeah. And after that, I published my first book with Jess Pan during my doctorate and realized that that was the area I wanted my life to go, you know, but I couldn't give up the doctorate. I had to finish it, you know, it already is a sunk cost fallacy. Yeah. So I finished the doctorate in cinema studies, and but then I thought, well, if I'm just going to write, I could be living anywhere. And I love London, but in terms of quality of life, in terms of, you know, what feels like my city, you know, Paris was where I wanted to be. So yeah. I still had a lot of friends there, moved back to France. It's been, yeah, since 2018 is when I moved back. So amazing. Yeah, it's been wonderful. It is a great country to live in. I mean, there are the glamorous aspects. It's very funny. I was teaching a writing class this semester and of exchange students from the United States. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them in their early essays were writing about Emily in Paris and kind of their experiential essays. And I was like, okay, just wait, you know, see what you think. Because you know, the rats on the subway are not necessarily featured in that show.
Yeah, cutscenes. Those are cutscenes.
Exactly. Bloopers. But no, it's a wonderful place to live, to work, to write, of course.
I love it. It's on my list. So I'm in Scotland now and I have been an expat. Similar experience, studied abroad in the UK, went back for my master's, moved back to live in 2008. And something that's been interesting for me is writing about America and Americans and in my American voice that exists in my head, but from abroad. I mean, have you had that experience kind of writing? Your book is very much set in the New Haven in New York, 2005, 2006. You know, do you think that you have a different perspective of that sitting in Paris working on this versus if you were living full time in the US?
It's really hard to say. It's hard to say, you know, it's hard to imagine, you know, alternate world, alternate universe, Rachel. But probably it's tricky because, of course, I've also gotten older and we've all lived through, you know, the late 2010s. We've all lived through a pandemic since then. So, you know, when I was writing this and trying to get back into the mindset of college, you know, that I had had in college, you know, of, you know, which I loved college, despite everything I've said here. It was really a wonderful time. It was incredible experiences. It's afterwards that, again, the structures that allowed me to be there, that allowed my friends to be there, that allowed the people I knew to be there kind of became a lot more evident. So I really think it's time more than distance. But in some ways, also, I mean, living in a country with a fairly progressive government, you know, Macron is not progressive in the European sense, but for Americans, he's like Bernie Sanders.
Exactly. He's off the charts.
Has, especially in contrast with kind of American government of, you know, a few years ago, got to see very different like pandemic responses, very different kind of structural things that really ended up affecting like my daily life, certainly in the daily life of, I think, a lot of people in France. So so there is something to be said of, you know, for that kind of simultaneous alternate universe. where you do get that distance. But in terms of the distance, I don't know. I think there certainly is something to be said for, you know, for living under different institutions and trying to understand the way that they function.
Well, yeah, it gives you a different perspective, doesn't it? You know, you kind of see the assumptions of that things are all like this everywhere. And then you go somewhere else and you're like, oh, maybe things can be different somewhere else. And what are the reasons why things are the way they are? I think it's really fascinating. And even the culture at those like top tier universities in France, in the UK, and in the US, they're very different. They're very, very different in positive and negative ways. So,
you know, and in France, you know, the tuition is so much lower, as I've said, that, you know, and there aren't these X factors in admission, like extracurriculars and, you know, things that, like, you know, if you're working a job in high school, it can be so much more difficult to, because you're not also a theater star or, you know, a Rory Gilmore, you know, newspaper reporter, like deep dive there. But, you know, that those
separate podcasts we'll need to record, Rachel. If you're a Gilmore Girls fan, we could go down a whole rabbit hole.
Please, I'm in. But, you know, but without those X factors, you know, and they say, oh, it's completely a meritocracy, you know, and then you talk to people who've been through this system and they go, even then, it's not really, because the more elite high schools, the more exclusive high schools feed into these systems. You know, there are, you know, coded ways of writing that, you know, show your socioeconomic background and things like that. So, you know, I think as a kind of a progressive American, it's so easy for me to be like, oh, France is amazing. And France is going, we're better, but we still have problems.
Yeah. It's so fascinating. Now, tell me what you're working on now. Give us a sneak peek.
I'm working on two projects at the moment. First time I've done kind of a simultaneous pairing. Well, the first is a nonfiction project about this kind of medical mystery tour I was on for the past decade, and figuring out some strange symptoms in the UK, the US, and France, across the three systems. And that can be very heavy to write, so I need to kind of dip in and out. At the same time, I'm working on a project, another one set in France, like my first novel. But this one is about the French Resistance and generational trauma, but set in, again, the early 2000s, which is apparently I just want to regress to
look, it was a simpler time. It was a simpler time.
Oh, it's so funny to me now. Like, yeah, my students having this like a millennial, you know, envy. And I'm like, it was not that great, you guys. It was interesting, but we had our issues.
Yeah. I'm like, aren't you all wearing the same clothes now? Can't you see what this was all about? Those chokers were very uncomfortable.
Oh my God. I wore low-rise jeans for the first time in about 20 years. And I was like, these are terrible.
Oh my God. It makes me shudder to think about putting on a pair of low-rise jeans right now. Oh my God. Oh, Rachel, it's been so great to catch up with you. Let's finish this off with our classic question. I know you've already done this and you've already given your writerly advice. So what new writerly advice do you have for the listeners today?
Oh gosh.
It could be all that. You could repeat the same thing.
I'm like, I don't remember what I said.
Just any advice. If it's the same thing you said last time, then we're just going to say it's that good that it's really bears repeating.
Well, it's going to take a really passionate listener to compare and contrast. But I know all of the mom's audience is passionate, which is great. I think the biggest thing that I would say is just to dive into, you know, reading and writing the kind of stuff that you want to read and write as much as you possibly can. Read so widely within your genre, outside of your genre, you know, find the things that you love, try reading things that you would never think that you'd like, you know, dip in and out of different authors, go, you know, read everything one author's ever written, go into the acknowledgements, read everything all the authors she recommends, you know, keep doing that and play around. I think a lot of people don't necessarily know, you know, what they want to do in terms of genre, in terms of story until you write a lot, you play a lot and you throw a lot out. So that's my advice, is just to get in there as much as I can.
Yeah, I love it. Beautiful. Well, Rachel, The Fortune Seller is out now. Everybody needs to go and read it. Rachel, thank you again for being on Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram at Zibby Owens and at Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Also sign up for my newsletter at ZibbyOwens.com and sign up for my virtual book club and meet lots of authors on Zoom every other week. Thanks so much to Steve and Ryan at Texture Sound for the sound editing. And thank you to Morning Moon Productions for providing this fantastic intro and outro music.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.